This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. The Oscars take place in just a few days, and so today I'm sitting down with Kurt Loder, who reviews movies for Reason at Reason.com, and whose takes are syndicated all over the world by Creator Syndicate. We're going to find out what movies, actors, directors, writers, song makers, whatever, that Kurt thinks are deserving of Oscars, and which ones are not. But we're also going to go meta a little bit and talk about whether or not these types of award shows, kind of self-backclapping things like the Oscars, like the Grammys or the Tonys or the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I guess even, you know, should these things just kind of disappear? Are they 20th century phenomenon that we're better off leaving behind and let them sink into the ocean like good old Mr. Norman Maine, if you were a Star is Born fan? We're going to talk about changing attitudes towards music, TV, novels, and other aspects of pop culture. Kurt is a cultural omnivore who first started writing for rock magazines back in the 1970s, eventually becoming a big writer at Rolling Stone and co-authoring Tina Turner's memoir, What's Love Got to Do With It? In the 80s, he was on MTV as the news anchor, and there's a generation of people who still remember him for telling them that Kurt Cobain had committed suicide in the early 90s. Nowadays, the best place to find Kurt, other than at the pages of Reason.com, is on Sirius XM, where he hosts a show called True Stories, where he interviews rock and other types of musicians, and they tell stories that may or may not be true, but are always interesting. Kurt, thanks for coming on to the Reason Podcast.
It's my pleasure. How you doing?
Okay. And I should, I'll remind people won't necessarily know this, but this is the third time we're trying to do this because of technical glitches that my own advancing senility introduced into the process. But so it's getting a little familiar, and let's jump right into the Academy Award nominations. Okay, I'm looking at a list of Best Picture, and these include Black Panther, Black Klansman, it's Bohemian Rhapsody. I was going to say Black Bohemian Rhapsody because it seems like there's a trend, but
sequel.
Yeah, The Favorite, Green Book, Roma, A Star Is Born, and Vice. Which picture do you think is most deserving of Best Picture?
Well, there's so many. I mean, last year was a really, really strong year for movies, I think. You know, it used to be that critics would sit around the year's end and say, God, what an awful year this was. Movies really sucked. But it was a great year. And I don't know, Black Panther's a really good fantasy movie. I like that quite a bit. I like The Favorite a lot. And it was a big fan.
The Favorite is a court drama, right? An aristocratic court favorite.
Yeah, it's set in the early 18th century. It's about Queen Anne, who's like sort of a doddering matriarch, and she has this woman servant, I guess, who's scheming to use all her power, and there's some lesbian motifs running through it. And it's just very funny, beautiful. And it's one of those movies where you just look at the costumes and say, oh, my God, these are incredible. So it's worth seeing. I highly recommend it. If I were picking a movie, it would have to be A Star Is Born. It's old Hollywood all the way. It just goes over the top, and it's very sentimental, and it's very moving. A tear ran down my cheek, and I wasn't the only one. It's that kind of movie. There's so many things that are wonderful about it, especially Lady Gaga, who, of course, sings this song Shallow, and she's great. Just her first acting job, and she just knocks it out of the park.
How does it compare to the Kris Kristofferson, Barbara Streisand movie from the, I guess that was the 70s?
It towers above it.
Yes.
I think. I didn't care for that. I mean, like everybody likes the one from back in the, whatever it was, the 40s, the 30s.
There was the 50s, I think. Yeah, James Mason Garland, Judy Garland. And then there's the old, I think the original one is from the 30s with like Frederick March and Janet Gaynor or something. What do you think it is about that kind of that story? Because this, you know, it's been made at least three or four times, you know, of the kind of star-crossed, career-crossed lovers. Because you said this is kind of like old Hollywood or, you know, kind of traditional Hollywood at its best. What is the appeal of that story?
It's a broad outline human story. I mean, this big star, she's starting to wobble, and he's starting to he's starting to wobble. She is a young woman who's rising up, and you see them passing each other, and it just has an inherent, you know, tristesse to it. I think there's no denying it. You can sit and chuckle at it and make fun of it, but it works. It affects people, and that's why I think it's. And that's one of the reasons I think it's a really good movie.
I wonder if we will see, or when we will see, a movie where the gender roles are reversed. I mean, you know, you get some of that with Sunset
Boulevard.
Yeah, I was going to say, Sunset Boulevard is kind of like that, but it's played for laughs or dark humor, right? Because the old actress is a hag, even though I suspect that, and I'm sorry, I'm blanking on her name, the actress, you know, who's a silent film star in Queen Kelly and whatnot, was probably young, certainly younger than you or I are right now when she was playing that. So.
No doubt.
How about best director? We have Spike Lee for Black Klansman, Pawlikowski of Cold War, a Polish movie, Yorgos Lanthimos, Alfonso Cuarón, and Adam McKay.
I would go with Alfonso Cuarón because these are all admirable people, but Alfonso Cuarón shot Roma, and Roma is a very unusual film. It's shot in widescreen, black and white, and it's astonishing black and white. If you go to a theater to see it, you just marvel at how beautiful it is. It's great. And Cuarón, who's the director, shot the whole thing himself. So I think you've got to give it to him for this movie.
Wow. How do you get around that? I guess you got to work in Mexico to get around the union rules. Where if he's doing a one man band or something like that. But you know, one of the things that's interesting about Roma is that it's a Netflix movie, and it was streaming on Netflix, but it also had a theatrical run. Everybody I know, I have not seen it yet, but everybody I know who saw it in the theater said it is an absolute theatrical experience, like to be seen on the big screen. Do you feel like Hollywood has done a good job, or the entertainment industry, even as things become more and more ubiquitous and more convenient to stream, you know, on your phone or on something, you know, the size of a postage stamp, but they also really are bringing back that live or you know, that in-person experience at the theater?
I think so, yeah. The problem with theaters, of course, is that they're so expensive. You go in and somebody's sitting next to you using their phone. Yeah. Their projection is probably off. You know, the popcorn costs $10 a shot. It's not a pleasant experience. And so now you have theaters that are going for a high-end thing. You can walk in and they're like waiters bringing you food. I've been to these places.
Yeah.
So they're trying to fight back. I think Netflix is a great thing. A lot of people say, well, it's going to kill the theatrical experience. But it's great for movies. It's especially great for mid-level movies, indies. As Alfonso Cuarón was being interviewed by some reporter, and the reporter said, you know, you're contributing to the death of the theatrical experience. He said, look, I've got a black-and-white movie in Spanish. Where do you think that was going to get a wide release? And now it's being seen all over the world.
Do you remember the first movie you saw in the theater?
It might have been The Great Gilbert and Sullivan, which had Robert Morley in it. It was preceded by his stomach as he walked into the frame. One of the first movies I remember seeing was The Thing from Another World, the 1951 version, which my parents dropped me off to see when I was like six or something. Those were different times.
And that did that scare the hell out of you?
Yes, I was terrified.
Yeah, because and although
in a great
that,
way.
Yeah, that I you know I came to that after seeing I guess the remake by John Carpenter around 1981 or something, which also I thought was very good. And
that's a great movie. Yeah.
It is amazing, you know, that kind of emotional response that you get to early movies, and I think it you know that those are the people who go on to become film critics, right? You know that that meant something to you. Or serial killer.
Or become, you know, disturbed in some way.
Yes.
Possibly, I think, because, everything you see, everything you do when you're very young, I think, imprints on you. So it's important what you're going to see. But, a lot of the stuff that I saw a lot of junk when I was young, as you do. So I've had a lifelong penchant for junk.
Yeah. It's that's a huge baby boom phenomenon. I'm at the tail end of the baby boom, but it is, one of the things that the junk culture that informs so much of rock music and punk music and things like that. It's odd. It was, there's so much nostalgia, and I guess it's not unique to the baby boom, but you are on some level recapturing something you remember from your youth as you get older and older in movies, it seems, in music.
I think that's probably true. you don't want the same thing over and over again. I think if you're, when you're young, you find somebody say, boy, I love the energy of this, or I love the way this moves, or I love this actor. I think maybe you go through life wanting to find another really great actor, or a great velocity in a movie. So it's not just searching for something, you know, as a carbon copy.
Right. Well, let's talk about best actor. We've got Christian Bale. For Vice, he played Dick Cheney, Bradley Cooper, and A Star Is Born, Willem Dafoe at Eternity's Gate, where he's playing Vincent van Gogh, Rami Malek, who plays Freddie Mercury in Bohemian Rhapsody, and Viggo Mortensen, who plays Tony Lip in Green Book. Who do you think is the standout?
Well, again, these guys are all really good in these movies. I would have to go with Rami Malek. I think there's a lot of criticism of the Bohemian Rhapsody, the Queen movie, as not being accurate, and they're not putting enough focus on Freddie Mercury's being gay, which is totally wrong. It entirely does treat that subject. But I think he transformed himself and captured something about charisma and the rock business, and a guy who's just quietly determined to become a star. It's really impressive to watch him in this movie.
How big a change agent is probably a bad term for it, but somebody like Freddie Mercury, when you think of when he emerged onto the pop stage or the rock stage, and Queen, I mean, they're in a tradition of people like David Bowie and kind of more theatrical performers and whatnot. But I mean, he was a really weird looking figure who, you know, was making music that nobody else was making. How big a deal was Freddie Mercury, do you think, in kind of the evolution of rock into something approaching art?
I think it drew people's attention. I mean, as a hard rock kind of guy, I mean, sometimes he looked like a member of the Village People. But he didn't care because he just went out and did what he wanted to do. And it's really kind of rousing to watch somebody like that and say, wow, you're not going to be told what to do by anybody. And I think that was a great thing about him. I think there have been gay people, like going back to Liberace in the 1940s and 50s, who was clearly gay. But people didn't care. He was a great entertainer. He was really good at what he did, and people loved him. So maybe Freddie's in that line. I'm not sure about that.
Let's talk about best actress. We have Yalitza Aparicio from Roma, Glenn Close in The Wife, Olivia Colman in The Favorite, Lady Gaga in A Star Is Born, and Melissa McCarthy in Can You Ever Forgive Me?
I so wish Melissa McCarthy could win this. She's so good in Can You Ever Forgive Me? She's just wonderful. Olivia Colman is really good in The Favorite. Yalitza Aparicio is the star of Roma. She's not an actress. She's like a school teacher or something from a remote section of Mexico. It's amazing that she got through this movie. She does sort of have a presence, but she's not an actress. She can't project, and I'm sort of puzzled why she's in this category. I think the winner should be Lady Gaga because she's astonishing in every way.
And I mean, I guess one of the interesting things about Lady Gaga too is that she's just getting started. I mean, you know, she's obviously been around as a music performer for a while, but even there, she's not been around that long. And as an actress, do you think she's going to have one of the one of the great careers? I mean, similar to somebody like a Barbara Streisand.
Well, she could. I mean, she's really, really a great singer, and she's also really a musician. I mean, she can actually just sit down at a piano and play, like, amazing material. So she's got everything it takes. She's obviously dedicated to her career, and she's one of those rare people. She comes along, and she seems to have it all. I guess we'll see soon enough.
It's kind of annoying, actually,
It is annoying. It is annoying.
Do you feel like, and I realize I'm jumping back and forth between music and rock and film and everything, but are musicians such as Lady Gaga, are they more serious about their careers than they used to be? I mean, like, she seems to be unlikely to fuck this up by, you know, going into a tailspin, either of just not working very hard or becoming, you know, some kind of hermit addict or something like that. There's like an incredible
kind of addict.
Yeah. It is true. If you're going to be an addict, it probably is better to be a hermit. But the work ethic just seems like unbelievable.
Well, I think that's always been true. I mean, especially if I noticed this in the early days of rap, that the hardest working people in show business were rappers. Mm-hmm. They were totally devoted to their careers. How can they maximize? How can they merchandise? I mean, they were serious businessmen, and they were working really, really hard. So they deserved whatever they got with it. I think you always have to be serious about your career. She obviously is. And somebody like Melissa McCarthy, too, she's been at it for a long time. She's still here, and she's taking a chance. I mean, she always does these kind of fat lady comedies, and she's good at that. But Can You Ever Forgive Me is a totally different role for her.
Talk and a little bit about what that movie, I think it's probably one of the less seen movies that's got nominated for stuff. What's the backstory of Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Well, it's based on a true story, and it's about a woman who was a writer, sort of a minor biography writer in the 1950s, and she decided she couldn't get any more book deals, so she found out that if you have memorabilia, like a letter from a famous person, you can sell it for quite a bit of money. This is in memorabilia stores. So she started faking memorabilia. You know, I have this letter from Noel Coward, and she gets $400 for it. It's really funny. And Richard E. Grant plays this this ne'er-do-well guy who assists her. The two of them together are just unbelievable. They're so, so good. I hope more people do see this movie, and I'm sure they'll see it on Netflix or something.
Oh, Netflix. It's ruining everything. Do we have to keep talking about Netflix?
No, it's making everything so much better.
Yeah. No, and obviously, you know, the other thing that I think Netflix and Amazon streaming as well, and it's not like they created it. I mean, they're picking up on stuff that places like HBO and Showtime have done. But, you know, the creation where we now take it for granted that we're going to have these incredibly novelistic, thick, ongoing series that might last for, you know, seasons and seasons. We're very punishing, I think, as viewers. We immediately take for granted anything good and then just are kind of like, well, what comes next? But,
I think you're going to reach a point where people realize I can't devote my life to watching all 300 episodes of whatever this stupid series is. And you just don't have time. You can't read and watch TV and go see movies. It's like you just be home all the time.
Well, thankfully, you know, none of us work anymore, so it's like we at least have more free time. So Best Supporting Actor, we have Mahershala Ali in Green Book as Don Shirley, Adam Driver in Black Klansman, Sam Elliott in A Star Is Born, Richard E. Grant, who you just mentioned in Can You Ever Forgive Me, and Sam Rockwell, who plays George W. Bush in Vice.
Well, I love Sam Rockwell. I don't know about this, but Mahershala Ali is very good in Green Book. He's a very appealing actor. Adam Driver is good, but he's always good. And Sam Elliott is just a charismatic presence. He doesn't have much to do in A Star Is Born, but when he's there, you really feel him. Richard E. Grant should win in this category, and I think he will, because everybody's talking about him. I don't think he's ever been nominated. He did a movie about 30 years ago called With Nail and I, in which he played a drunk, who was very entertaining. He's playing a drunk in this movie, too, and the ironic thing is that he's physically incapable of drinking. Richard E. Grant,
and
he's very good at playing drunks.
So he cannot, he will die if he takes a drink.
He can't metabolize alcohol.
Really?
I think he may have tried it. I was talking to him because we hang out together all the time. And he said, I think he may have had a drink once, but he can't do it. But he really plays a drunk really, really well, and he does it in this movie especially. Can You Ever Forgive Me?
This is the Best Supporting Actor category. It's an embarrassment of riches. I agree with you. Sam Rockwell is one of those. Actually, all of them are like this, where their shittiest performance is, like, you know, off the charts. But what about Sam Elliott is now an elder statesman, and he is this, you know, he makes every movie better. Like, as great a shitty movie Roadhouse is, it's like made 10 times better by Sam Elliott being in there. What is it about, you know, Ghost Rider, the Nick Cage movie with that crummy superhero comic, what is it about Sam Elliott that, what's he doing? Because he also never seems to be doing anything. He's just he's like a black hole. Your light, the light just bends towards him.
I think he just incorporates the values of, you know, frontier America. I mean, he seems like the most sincere, the strongest personality, and he doesn't have to do a lot to project that. He's very good at that. And you know, Lifeguard was his first movie. I still remember that. I thought he was great in that. Roadhouse, of course, is a classic. But he doesn't have a lot to do in A Star Is Born, but his role was the angry brother of the Bradley Cooper character. Mm-hmm. It's really, you can feel it when he's there. And of course, The Big Lebowski, he's been in so many movies.
Right.
It's good to have him back, and it's good to see him nominated.
Do you vote in any of this? Are you a member of the Academy?
No, I'm a member of SAG, but I don't think
okay. So, Best Supporting Actress. Amy Adams, who plays Lynn Cheney in Vice, Marina de Tavera in Roma, Regina King in If Beale Street Could Talk, Emma Stone in The Favorite, and Rachel Weisz also in The Favorite.
Yeah, Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz are a great team in The Favorite, along with Olivia Colman. The three mm-hmm. of them are, it's like one performance. And it's so interconnected. You almost don't want to see them all nominated. If I had to go for somebody here, and Amy Adams has been nominated over and over again as number one, but I would have to go with Regina King. And If Beale Street Could Talk, it's so sad. It's so moving what she does in that movie.
Is this a rare, just looking at supporting actress, this seems to be a rare moment where none of them are prostitutes or addicts?
It's true. I don't know what went wrong.
Yeah, obviously. Well, I guess this is what happens when Harvey Weinstein gets kicked out of Hollywood, right?
Exactly. Oh. I mean, two of them are lesbians, so that's something. But we want more, I think. I think Blake Lively in A Simple Favor should have been in this category because she's a real old Hollywood thing. She wears like tuxedos and she's like vampy in it. She's great. Everybody should go see A Simple Favor.
Best Animated Feature Film. We have The Incredibles 2, Isle of Dogs, Mirai, Ralph Breaks the Internet, and Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Do you have a strong opinion about the best animated feature film?
Well, I think Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is probably going to win those. It's very original. And I would normally say The Incredibles, but I don't think the second one was as good as the first movie, which is really a watershed event. So I go with Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
What... Is it a good thing that animation is back? And obviously it's been back, I guess, more or less since The Little Mermaid in the late 80s. But, you know, there was that period where, and certainly I remember the animated movies I saw growing up tended to suck. What happened that animation is somehow now not just a live thing, but it actually some, fantastic, artistic statements come out of that?
Well, and technology. I think it's been like 30 years since Pixar made their first film, which was a short. And Pixar has really transformed everything because they're so committed to digital animation, which has changed everything. There are things you can do with that you can't afford to do with drawn, animation, which is very labor intensive. So I think that helps. It's expensive, but it's probably getting less expensive, and you can do amazing thing with it. It's eye-popping work can be done with digital.
Yeah. Let's pull back. That's most of the major awards. Is there an award that you are particularly rooting for a particular person to win that we haven't mentioned?
Well, I think there should be an annual Nicolas Cage Award just for him. He had a movie called Mandy last year, and there's just nothing. There is nothing else like that movie. It's like he should get it for that. Apparently, he's doing a new movie, which he says will be even wilder. So we'll see. Promises.
In the collection of reviews that you published a few years ago, you had what was it? The good, the bad, and the downright awful.
Or... I did. Yeah.
But you had a special section for Nicolas Cage. What is your obsession with him, and what happened to him?
I think we can say everybody's obsession with him. Let's go for that. Well, David Lynch said he's like the jazz musician of actors, and I think that's true. He does things. He just makes choices while you're watching him, and you say, "Whoa, man!" What was the Ghost Rider? The one,
right.
or no, the
yep.
other movie. I forget the other movie. The movie where he was in hell and his daughter back up on Earth got in trouble, and Nick hopped in a car in hell and drove back to Earth to save her. It is one of the greatest movies ever made.
Do you take him seriously? And I'm not saying you're not when you're looking at these wild and weird movies and like the awful things like the remake of The Wicker Man, which is just Even more unwatchable than the original. But then there were movies, and I'm thinking of, like, it was kind of a small movie. It's got to be almost 25 years old now, called Red Rock West, where he played.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like an existential neo-Western. And, you know, it's like a quiet, small movie, and he's brilliant in it. Like, do you think he'll make a movie that will, like, fully deliver on a kind of conventional promise that he has as an actor, or is he too into the odd stuff now?
I don't think he'll ever be conventional. I mean, I admire the fact that he'll try stuff which doesn't work out very well. He says that he'll do something for money, and then the next movie will be something that he really likes a lot. A lot of money troubles for a while,
right,
with the IRS.
Right, yeah.
So, but he's done a lot of very interesting movies, and the weird stuff is just wonderful too. So whatever he does, it doesn't even matter. You know, does it say Nicolas Cage on the box? I'll take it home with me.
Is there on a trial basis?
Is
there anybody else like is somebody like Brando like that as well, or do you think Nick Cage is the most compulsively watchable actor ever?
Well, I don't know. Marlon Brando was a great actor, but he did a lot of crap too. I mean,
he did
a lot of really, really, really bad movies, and he just didn't seem to care. You know, I don't know. Even the bad stuff he did, though, he was the best thing in the bad movie. So,
yeah.
But I don't think anybody's like Nicolas Cage. He's one of a kind, I think.
So let's talk about the Oscars as an institution, you know, and they're there to, fet Hollywood itself, an institution. Are we done? You know, the Academy Awards this year famously couldn't get anybody to host it because Kevin Hart had, you know, some bad tweets in the past. Is this like a sign that we should just be saying, stop, Academy Awards, just go away? Or it's like the State of the Union. They should just publish the list instead of having a performance based around it.
Well, the first Academy Awards, I think it was in 1927, lasted about less than half an hour, I think. So it can be done. And, you know, I think the Academy Awards, the problem with the Academy Awards, I think, is clear. There are too many showpiece things that stop the show. Here's a dance number. Here's this. Here's that. Here's, like, a list of dead people. And there's just so much of that, and it just drives you crazy. However, that's not going to stop while they keep making money with this show. And I'm sure they do, even though, you know, viewership has plummeted over the last 10 years or so.
Yeah, what do you think about other... I mean, it seems like that's a common trend for award shows.
Yeah.
You know, the Grammys, the Emmys, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame performances. Are we as a society, are we getting done with this kind of stuff? And is that a good thing?
Well, some of us are, I think. I mean, imagine being 15 years old and you're tuning into the Academy Awards and hear all these jokers in, like, evening wear, standing outside in L.A. where it's like 3 p.m. in the broiling sun, and they're all pretending like they're really important, and they go inside and they're all clapping and getting close-ups on camera. It just seems so old and played out, it seems to me, and it might be a generational thing. If you're younger, you have so many other things you can do. You can see movies that the Academy Awards have never heard of. You know, you're just in a different headspace entirely, I think.
You know, as I mentioned in the introduction, you're a cultural omnivore, and I know I've personally benefited from various recommendations you've given in terms of music and in terms of books, as well as movies, you know. But, you know, on the one hand, in a broad way, we have absolutely more access to more stuff being done, you know, that you can access at every conceivable moment, or you can even produce yourself. On the other hand, we have... You know, speech policing that seems really out of control, you know, barely suppress rage about everything on social media, and, you know, public apologies like we're living in Mao's cultural revolution all the time.
Yeah.
Do you think overall, is this a good time or a bad time for cultural expression?
Well, it's the best and worst of times. You know, it's just, you know, when you see this reactive sort of response to social media and what people are saying, it's like the 1950s again. It's really so old, and you just want to say, God, what's going on? On the other hand, we do live in a time when it's like pornography is available whenever you want it. If you're 10 years old, it pops right up in front of you. So I think people are sort of gun-shy about that sort of thing. It's a new element. I don't know. I think it's great what goes on. There are problems with social media, But what it has accomplished is really astonishing. It's really transformed our age.
What are you listening to these days that you think more people should know about?
Oh, let me see. I'm waiting for some stuff. Actually, I'm a fan of this guy Steve Gunn, who's like a guitar player who has all kinds of interesting kind of open tunings for all the guitar players out there. I like him a lot. He's got a new album out. I like Tal Wilkenfeld, who's an Australian woman who plays bass, and she's an incredible bass player. Apart from being like a singer and stuff, she plays with Jeff Beck. She's played with everybody, and she's a killer jazz bassist. So she's fun, and I really like Bad Baby. I'm like of the three or four people of my age who like her a lot. She's this girl named Danielle Bregoli, and she became famous like 3 years ago. And her mother took her on the Dr. Phil show. Because she didn't know what to do with her anymore because she was such a problem. The name of the show was, I wrote this down, I Want to Give Up My Car-Stealing, Knife-Wielding, Twerking 13-Year-Old Daughter Who Tried to Frame Me for a Crime. So she was on Dr. Phil, and apparently during a break in the show, she snuck outside and stole the car of one of the crew members. So she's got a rap sheet. She's 13. And she somehow got picked up by, well, she's an internet star, so she was picked up by a manager. And before you know it, she had a 2-album contract with Atlantic Records, and she's a rapper. And it would just be another big mistake in the social media world, except that I think she's a good rapper. She has a real interesting flow, as they say, and she works with some great producers. I like her tracks a lot. She seems to be an insufferable egomaniac. I mean, I wouldn't want to be around her. She had a run-in with David Spade in which she claimed not to know him or something, and it was kind of unkind to him, but in the end, he volunteered to be in a video she did. So she's interesting, and she also, I should also, mention she did a really interesting video about a pedophile, which is something in the news, and she did a video for her mom saying, you know, Mom, don't worry, I'm not going to go down the dark road. So there's something else to her besides just the sensation.
Do you feel as you get older and as, you know, the music of your youth either kind of starts to fade or it gets repackaged and replayed, because there aren't that many different ways to do popular music, really. When will you stop keeping up?
I guess if I doze off or nap or something, I don't know. I don't try to keep up. I mean, there are places to hear music. You stop by, you see if there's anything that moves you. I mean, keeping up is like a duty. You know, these 20 songs are on the charts. I must listen to them. I must see what they're all about. That's more like working in the music industry, which I've done. It sort of sometimes takes the fun out of everything. So I'm just happy, you know, bouncing around and coming across something and saying, well, this is really good, you know.
Yeah.
This excites me in a way I've always been excited by music. That's the best you can hope for, I think.
What about in terms of novels or fiction? What are you reading these days?
Let me see. I just got a new book by Don Winslow, who writes thrillers about, well, crime novels about the border and about, you know, cartel culture and stuff. This one's called The Border. It's the third one. His first book, or one of his books, is being made into a movie as we speak, and he's just astonishing. He's such a great chronicler of this scene, and he does a lot of reporting. There's a lot of information in his books, and I like that a lot. I just got a book by Jasper Ford, which I haven't started. I'm a big fan of the Thursday Next books he did. They're incredible. And Barry Eisler is another guy who does these crime thrillers. And he's another one of these people you just hate, because he used to work for the CIA. And then he was like a stockbroker. And then he became like a black belt karate champion in Japan. And just stop, you know, just stop. He's just making us all look bad. But I love his books. He's a great writer.
Well, I think we will leave it there. Kurt, thank you for sharing your Oscar picks, what you're listening to, and some good reads that you've taken up. We've been talking with Kurt Loder. He reviews movies at Reason.com, and he's also the host of a show on Sirius XM. What is the channel, or where is the best place to find you on Sirius XM?
Channel 106 on the part of Sirius XM that is called Volume. If you go to Sirius XM, you'll find it. It's called True Stories.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. This has been The Reason Podcast. I have been Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Apple, at Google, at Spotify we're on, or go to Reason.com and look us up and get us into your feed. Thanks very much for listening.